Chapter 2. There's an old Japanese belief to the effect that if you save somebody's life, you become responsible for it. No one in modern Japan followed the old ways anymore, but Kami was not exactly a modern Japanese. I'm not sure what the hell she was, but after a few days, I started to think about staying there with her. It would have been a very foolish thing to do. My life expectancy as a Bushido bandit wouldn't have been much greater than it was already, and I was looking to increase it. Besides, I couldn't really see myself decked out in lycras and studded leather, zooming around the city on a hot scooter and terrorizing the Zens. It would not have been an equal partnership. I had nothing to contribute to her world, and she had very little to contribute to mine. But what little she had to contribute would stay with me for a long time. And as unselfconsciously, or unconsciously, as she gave it, it was nevertheless something to be valued. She didn't ask anything at all of life, but within the narrow spectrum of the world she lived in, she took all it had to offer. And if it didn't offer, she took it anyway. You could make a lot of superficial observations about someone like Kami. You could say that she was self-destructive, that she was irresponsible, that she was a social misfit, that she was violent and immoral and confused, and all of those things would have been true, at least to some extent, but they would nevertheless be superficial observations. Sean O'Toole had taught me, by example, if not by words, that people are rarely simple creatures. It's easy to make snap judgments, stick on labels, make a decision based on that, and move on to the next thing. Lots of people do it and manage to get through life and their various relationships more or less okay, but they seldom learn much. Life is infinitely complicated, and people are a part of life. Kami wasn't my true love, and I sure wasn't hers, but there was something there, and that something wasn't merely lust. It was a surprise for both of us. I watched Kami try to work her way around it, fail to find a category that would conveniently fit, and then just shrug and go with it. I admired her for that. It wasn't that I was a great lover or that I overwhelmed her with my terrific personality. I don't think the man's been born who would be capable of overwhelming that young woman with anything. She wasn't shogun of that bandit squadron for nothing. No, what it was, I think, is that we were just two very different people who, for some unfathomable reason, were able to create something together that made us feel warm, secure, and more of whatever it is we were in the first place. It would be nice if that were enough. Many people make the mistake of thinking that it is, but we've become too civilized for such simplicity. For the other bandits, who had given up trying to understand life, or were too busy burning it up to bother trying, our relationship was not something to puzzle over greatly. I was just something on a plate life had served up, and Kami had decided to sample it. Period. Acceptance. I was with Kami until Kami decided I wasn't with her anymore, and they would figure out how to deal with that when it came around, if it turned out to be something that required dealing with. For Kami, it wasn't quite so simple. And for me, it was even less so. We didn't have anything in common except an intense emotional attraction. The physical aspect of it was merely the catalyst. It was a fire that burned intensely when it first lit and then died down to a comfortable glow in which we both found a very special warmth. We spent a lot of time basking in that warmth, simply lying there together, bodies touching. She didn't talk much, and I talked a great deal, not only to fill the silence, but because she listened and she didn't judge or comment. She just accepted, with that characteristic shrug of hers. A shrug that did not dismiss, but recognized with its own peculiar eloquence that life was that way sometimes. She took it all in with those hard, dark Asian eyes of hers. Eyes that always seemed to have little crosshairs in them, except for those special moments in that filthy corner behind the crates. excuse me, except for those special moments in that filthy corner back behind the crates, when they would look at me with more affection than I would have thought possible from such a wild creature. I was with the bandits for 5 days. I didn't ride with them. I preferred to stay behind and keep company with myself. I had a lot of sorting out to do, and I needed the time alone. I wondered what might have happened if I were 26 again, but I didn't wonder about that for very long because it was utterly pointless. I wouldn't have been the same person. I wasn't even the same person who ran into Cammy's scooter and uttered a desperate plea for help. She had given it to me, no questions asked, and no conditions imposed. And it wasn't only a matter of having saved my life. In her instinctive, inarticulate way, she gave me a leg up. A leg up I needed badly. She was exactly what I needed, at exactly the right time. And somehow, we knew that if we took it any further, it would sour for both of us. 5 days is only an eye blink, but under the right circumstances, a moment can seem like an eternity. It was no great feat to recognize that I had made a mess of things. It was pointless to regret anything that happened. The cards were dealt, and I had played them, and it had been my decision to sit down at the table. The game wasn't over yet, but it was past time for a new deck. Before I left, I cleared up a few final matters. I talked it over with the bandits, and after laughing like hell about it, they decided it was a marvelous idea. I never would have dared to contemplate anything like that before. But Sakara was correct in thinking me too dangerous now, that I had nothing left to lose. Cammy had shown me how to hang it out over the edge and just accept whatever happened. It would have required major excavations of some labyrinthian corporate mazes to trace down the ownership of Sakara's Ginza holdings, and the trail would have led to me, not to Sakara. As the nominal controlling interest of Sakara's Ginza operations, his tame insurance policy against being embarrassed now that he had risen to more reputable heights, I had never actually controlled a thing, although legally I was entitled to. It took some interesting maneuvering and a lawyer with a kinky sense of theater, but I succeeded in transferring my controlling interests to the bandits as a corporate entity. The thought of being a corporation sent them into hysterics. I didn't think it would hurt Sakara very much, but it would hit him where he lived and, not coincidentally, sever all ties I had with the Ginza. I never suspected what it would lead to. I had nowhere to go, and no money to go there. And staying in Tokyo would have been decidedly unhealthy. On the other hand, Psychodrome owed me a grand prize. It was both the longest and the shortest 5 days of my life. At the end of it, I had only 2 days left in which to claim my prize. The bandits gave me an escort to the shuttle, and we said brief goodbyes. Cammy never removed her helmet. I watched them as they zoomed off until they were out of sight. She never looked back. Every now and then, Psychodrome ran a game round in which a rank beginner, a lottery winner, was partnered with several of the Psycho superstars. The whole thing was a massive multimedia public relations event in which the preparatory stages to game initiation were broadcast, and the home audience got to follow the lucky winner through every step of the initiation process in addition to the gaming round itself. The idea was to stimulate sales in the lottery. The company decided I was the perfect candidate for one of these extravaganzas. I wasn't aware of the extent to which public curiosity had built up around me. It was rare for a lottery winner not to contact Psychodrome within hours, if not moments, of the announcement of the prize. 5 days had gone by without any word from me. I'd become something of a mystery man. In most large cities, there are certain members of the news media who specialize in covering crime. These people take great pride in their contacts and their knowledge of the underworld. In Tokyo, however, and especially on the Ginza, things didn't really work that way. On the Ginza, nobody, but nobody talked to reporters. The Yakuza was treated with the same respect that ancient peasant farmers used to give the samurai, and with good reason. A reporter's not going to yank your heart out of your chest and show it to you before you die. As a result, no one knew about my connection with Sakara and his Ginza holdings. Sakara wanted to make sure it remained that way. Ironically, so did I, in spite of the fact that he had tried to have me killed. Psychodrome represented a way out, and I didn't want to give them any reason to disqualify me. I'm sure Sakara understood that, but he was not the sort of man to leave loose ends lying around. I was a very loose end. No one knew anything about me, and no one had any idea where I was, so speculation was running high. It made for great news and great drama, and the effect had not been lost on Psychodrome. I had flashed them by screen to arrange passage on the shuttle to New York and have somebody meet me when I landed. I had no idea what a circus they'd have waiting. The first thing they had done was inform the media of my arrival, so the reporters were out in force. The second thing was to orchestrate a scene guaranteed to get me maximum exposure and deny the reporters access to me as I got off the shuttle. Their timing was perfect. They hustled me into the limo just slowly enough to make sure there was sufficient coverage, but too quickly and efficiently to allow anyone to get close. I hadn't expected it, so I was a little stunned. The first thing that registered clearly was the guy sitting across from me in the back of the limo, telling me not to say anything to anybody until they had the angles right. "You looked confused back there," he said. "That was great. Just keep on looking that way. What is all this? What's happening to me? Why has my life suddenly been turned all upside down? It's perfect. Perfect. That's just the way we're going to play it. An ordinary guy overwhelmed by an extraordinary event. We'll keep them on the hook until we get the press conference straight, and then we'll feed it to them exactly the right way. Meanwhile, we keep them in suspense. What's the story anyway? Where were you for 5 days? I blinked at him. I don't know, I said. I'm all confused. I keep asking myself, what is all this? What's happening to me? Why has my life suddenly been turned all upside down? He stared at me. You trying to be funny? I'm only trying to be cooperative. Where are we going? To your hotel. The word is to lock you up tight until we're ready to get the ball rolling. Arcady, old buddy, you've got no idea what we've got set up for you. I was never fond of people who called me by my first name when I didn't even know them, and I liked it even less when they mispronounced it. The way he said it, it rhymed with arcade, and it doesn't. It's not Arcady, it's Arcady, with the accent on the second syllable. This character had his accents wrong all over the place. He was wearing shiny blue pants with a zoomy orange jacket, a diaphanous red scarf draped around his neck just so, and he had one of those geometric haircuts every young bandit in Tokyo was wearing about 3 years earlier, which probably meant he was au courant with New York style. I had never been to New York, but I had met New Yorkers on my home ground, and the problem with New Yorkers is that they never seem to realize that they're not on their home ground when they go somewhere else. That's unfortunate because if you fail to pick up your cues, people might think you're ill-mannered. However, I was on their home ground now, so I had to readjust my timing suitably.
First of all, I said,
who are you?
Bob Steers, Media Relations.
Okay, Bob. Now, here's the way it is. Things have been moving just a bit too fast for me lately. I'm feeling edgy and tired, and I haven't had a chance to absorb any of this yet, if you know what I mean. I appreciate you meeting me, and I appreciate your getting me a room, and I appreciate Psychodrome going to all this trouble, but right now all I want to do is get somewhere quiet, wash up, and shut my eyes for a few hours. I'm not going to be of much use to you or anybody else until I've had a chance to do that, so if you don't mind, I'd really like to hold the conversation for a while. He stared at me for a moment, then gave a little snort, and shook his head.
Yeah, sure, what the hell? First time in the big city, right? You want a drink?
No thanks.
Oh, you don't mind if I do.
The question might have been polite had the tone not been sarcastic.
It's your party.
Right. You might want to think about that.
I leaned back and closed my eyes. I was aware of his gaze for several moments. Then the awareness went away. I opened one eye and saw him sitting sideways, talking to a screen with the speaker switched off and the remote set's receiver up close to his face, privacy shield hiding his mouth. I guess the company was being informed that I might be a little troublesome. I didn't want to be particularly troublesome, but Bob Steers, media relations, had rubbed me the wrong way. I was tired of being treated like a commodity. I had used those 5 days in the zone to think about who I was and what I had become and where I was going. It's not easy to consider things like that sometimes, especially if you're honest with yourself. I had been about as honest with myself as I knew how to be, and I hadn't liked any of the answers very much. Guilt can do savage things to you. It can tear you apart, or it can be a potent driving force. The trouble with guilt as a driving force is that often you don't know what it is that's driving you. You think you've got it all under control. You've shoved the guilt back into a convenient, dark little corner of your mind, and your iron will isn't going to let it get to you. But the subconscious has a lot of leprechaun in it. It has a tendency to wait until you least expect it, then open little trap doors in your brain out of which spring nasty things that yell, "Surprise!" In my case, what leaped out was Sean O'Toole, all 6'6" and 280 pounds of him, saying, "Fucked up again, huh?" We had a long talk, his shade and I. We discussed the one thing I had always wanted to do more than anything else and couldn't, and that was to live up to him. The trouble was, there wasn't enough of me to do that. Sean had agreed in his amiable way, and then he had said a most unexpected thing. He asked me why I bothered. He never said anything of the sort while he had been alive. He was much too busy being Sean O'Toole. But as a ghost, he was much more amenable. I didn't start to stutter at the mere thought of talking to him. He died about 3 years after I arrived in Tokyo, never knowing what his baby boy had got into. But it wasn't until we had our little conversation back inside my brain that I stopped being intimidated by him. Time, experience, and the impenetrable veil had helped take care of that. We had the sort of conversation I always wished we could have had while he had been alive, but I had been too young to know the right questions to ask, and he had never had the time for giving answers. In reanimating him inside the bandit's warehouse, I suddenly saw him in a different light. I understood his limitations, and I thought I understood why he had them. In his own way, the SOB had loved me. He hadn't known how to go about it very well. He was a winner in all the games he played, except the most important one. I had finally become a winner too, and not only because I won the lottery. I'd won back myself, the self I gambled away to Sakara when I made up my mind to make a life for myself and to succeed at it better than my father had, to grab onto everything I could get my hands on and hold on at all costs. It wasn't worth it. Nothing's worth losing yourself. I wound up with nothing. But Cammy helped me realize that nothing wasn't such a bad thing to have if it was yours. Free and clear. New York did not look all that much different from Tokyo to me. It was more spread out, but it was just as huge, just as dense, just as congested. The tops of its towers were lost in a murky gray haze, and the jumble of interlacing streets below made it impossible to see down to the lower levels, which was probably just as well. The city looked older than Tokyo, and dirtier. The traffic was thick, but it moved at a slower pace. There were not as many scooters, and the ones that were behaved a lot more sensibly than their cousins in Japan. Generations earlier, some ancestors of mine arrived by boat in New York Harbor, and the first sight that greeted them was the Statue of Liberty. It must have been a very moving experience for them, just as the sight of the Bradbury Obelisk must have been a moving experience for their descendants, generations later when they arrived on Mars. Miss Liberty no longer looked out over the harbor. She had been rebuilt and refurbished several times at great expense. It was decided to shield her from a hostile environment, and she now lifted her torch over the lobby of Liberty Towers, one of the city's more exclusive neighborhoods, connected to Manhattan Island by a multi-level causeway. I learned this from a tourist tape Bob Steers, media relations, had punched up on the set. It provided a convenient excuse for us to avoid having a conversation. Heaven forbid that we should have to suffer silence. I pretended a mild interest in the program until we reached our destination, the McDonald Plaza Hotel. The limo skimmed beneath the massive golden arches, and there was a hotel shuttle waiting to whisk me away to my suite before the reporters could close in. I wonder how they knew I'd be here, I said.
I thought the idea was to lock me up tight.
Bob Steers, media relations, gave me a funny look.
You mean we're talking now? You're some kind of character, you know that? Most people would give anything to be in your position, but you, what, this is just another day?
You should see some of my days.
Tell me about it,
Steers said.
I'd really like to know.
So you could figure out how to sell me to the media?
It's my job. But I'd also like to know what sort of man wins the Psychodrome lottery and acts like he couldn't care less. You're really not impressed by any of this, are you?
I'm impressed by the serendipity of it all, I said as we entered the suite. I looked around.
And I'm impressed by this room.
Steers took off his jacket and threw it down on a couch big enough to sleep six. He had a matching orange shirt on underneath.
Are you impressed by Stone Winters?
Who?
He stared at me.
Oh, come on. You're putting me on.
Oh, right. She's one of your top-rated psychos, isn't she?
I remember the name now.
You remember the name? This is a joke, right? How about putting it on hold while I try to find the shower in this place? I haven't washed in several days, and you've been very diplomatic by not mentioning it.
Christ, you really are a down-and-outer, aren't you?
Steers said.
You don't even own a sci-fi set, do you?
I didn't own anything except the clothes on my back. Still, I saw no reason to upset him by admitting that I used to own one, but never used it. I shook my head.
Well, no wonder,
Steers said.
You really have no idea what's happened to you, do you? You've never actually experienced the game. Hell, this is perfect! Perfect!
He started waving his arms around, working himself up into some kind of public relations frenzy.
Christ, I'm gonna go to town with this. Here's a guy who sunk about as low as you can sink, struggling and scratching for survival in one of the toughest, seediest places on the entire planet. Beaten down by life, nothing to look forward to, not even a chance to escape his dreary existence for a while with a fantasy because he doesn't even own a sci-fi set. This man's got nothing, nothing. Even his emotions have been deadened. He takes a desperate gamble, a long shot. The only shot he's got to get out from under. He takes the last bit of money he's got left and buys a chance in the lottery. Odds are 1 billion to 1. No, 1 trillion to 1 against him. And he wins. He doesn't even realize what he's won. All he knows is that he's out of the garbage heap, somewhere where he can breathe for once in his miserable life. And just for that, just for the chance to get out, he's willing to face whatever comes. Christ, it's made to order.
I shook my head with disbelief.
I gather you're pretty good at your job, I said.
Good?
He said.
Good? Arcadio, buddy. I'm the best. By the time I'm finished with you, you're going to be the hero of every down-and-out slob who can draw breath. You're going to be the reason for existing. You're going to be every man's role model, every woman's fantasy. The guy who's clawed his way out of the stinking lower levels of society, where you have to be a fucking animal just to survive, and bam! Fant leads you right into the big time. Arcadio O'Toole. The man with nothing to lose and the universe to gain. Damn, the fucking ratings are gonna zoom!
I left him to his ravings and went to take a shower. Ironically, there was a lot of truth in what he said, but hearing it from him that way made me feel particularly dirty. I took a long, hot shower and stretched out on a giant, comfortable bed. I had the door closed so I couldn't hear Bob Steers, media relations, as he cranked up his publicity machine. It was a hell of a nice bed, but I found myself missing a certain hard and filthy bed pad in a certain dark and filthy warehouse back in the combat zone of Tokyo. I wondered what Cammy was doing. If she had found herself another lover, or if she had crashed and burned trying some insane maneuver on her tiger-striped scooter. I had no idea that even as I was lying there, she was performing an even more insane maneuver than anything I'd seen her do on her scooter. A move destined to make certain Sakara never forgot about me. as long as I lived. I fell asleep at some point and dreamed about getting drunk back on the Ginza, waking up in Junktown. Only in the dream, I woke up with Cammy next to me. I told her that I blew it, there was nothing left, that we were stuck in Junktown with no idea of where our next meal was going to come from. She looked at me and shrugged. Suddenly, it didn't matter. The next several days were a blitzkrieg. Steers was like a turbocharger. The more energy he expended, the more power he generated. I was briefed and prepped and groomed and polished. Part of the process included getting a new wardrobe. But I appeared at the press conference in a faded, well-worn service uniform they found somewhere, one that made me look appropriately down-and-out-ish, in accordance with Bob Steers' media plan. I was presented to the public as an ex-serviceman from the wild outback of Mars who had fallen on hard times. There wasn't a great deal of truth in the presentation, but I suppose it didn't really matter. Steers and his staff then laid on a presentation that described the gaming round I would participate in, teamed with Psychodrome's two hottest stars, Stone Winters and Rutiger Breck. It was to be a sort of scavenger hunt composed of a number of challenging scenarios designed by one of the game's most celebrated player masters, Tolliver Mondego. I had no idea exactly how challenging those scenarios would be. Then Winters and Breck were introduced. I had never seen either of them before, but I knew something about them from my talks with Steers. Stone Winters was a dazzler, a dark and sultry young heiress, a member of the Fast set for whom Psychodrome represented the fastest ride around. She was already a celebrity when she started playing Psychodrome, but since turning full-time psycho, she'd become a major cult figure. She was 29 years old, smoky and vivacious, with a slightly raspy, whiskey baritone voice and smoldering eyes that sent out waves of raw, unadulterated sex. And she could turn it off and on like a flick of a switch. Steers didn't like her, and I suspected the reason was he'd made a move and been shot down. He said she was a jaded rich bitch who bought into sybaritic rounds of Psychodrome until some perverse impulse made her attempt a high-risk scenario. Apparently something clicked, and she discovered she was a thrill junkie, one of those people who thrive on walking the blade edge.
"She'll melt your mind, Arcady," Steers said, stubbornly mispronouncing my name despite numerous corrections. "But save yourself a lot of grief. I say this as a friend, okay? She's cold. She doesn't need men. Christ, she can get any man she wants. What can it mean to her? Her lover's death, if you ask me. She cock-teases the fucker."
Breck was another kind of creature altogether. He was the man home audiences loved to hate. The maverick who broke all the rules. Not that there were a lot of rules to break in Psychodrome. "His goal," said Steers, "was to accumulate enough experience points and prize money to become a player master."
"He used to be an SS commando," Steers said. "Lost his right arm from the shoulder down and got a bionic replacement. Designed it himself. It's an interesting piece of work. He's a top-notch player, but he's a freak. You don't believe me? Check out his eyes."
I had the distinct impression Steers didn't care much for any of the players, which made me wonder why he was being so solicitous of me. In Breck's case, he also seemed to have the same prejudice a lot of people had against those who had been bioengineered. I didn't share it, but I could understand it. Superior abilities can breed resentment. I did check out Breck's eyes, and what Steers had been referring to had nothing to do with bioengineering. Breck was a bang smoker, a comparatively rare vice on Earth because it was prohibitively expensive, and there was not a lot of call for it. Smoking in public was against the law in most countries, a holdover from the days when tobacco was still carcinogenic. Before the tobacco companies all went out of business, they'd been scrambling madly to develop a genetically engineered strain of tobacco that was not a health hazard. They finally succeeded, but by then smoking had become so socially unacceptable that there was no real market for it. On some of the colony worlds, the new strain of tobacco had taken hold and some people smoked it, but on Caribbea, some enterprising farmer had developed a hybrid of the mutated tobacco and a local plant called Bengala. The result was a potent stimulant. Smoking it had the effect of increasing adrenaline production, heightening visual acuity and tactile perceptions to an astonishing degree. This made bang very popular for use in sex, but it was highly addictive
and there were serious problems associated with having super amplified senses, had a curious side effect which made it easy to spot an addict. Prolonged and heavy use of Bang did something funny to the eyes. It made them glitter and become lambent like a cat's eyes when the light hit them just right. With the already striking aspect of Breck's ice blue eyes, the effect was unusually pronounced. He was tall and large framed, very muscular, with Aryan blonde hair and angular, cruel-looking features. There was a cool, soft-spoken, clipped, Teutonic aloofness about him, and he moved with the subtle, hair-trigger manner of the born soldier. He was the sort of man you couldn't help but notice in a crowd, without really knowing why. I knew why. It was because he was a wolf among the sheep. While the cameras were on, it was all good camaraderie, but the moment the press conference was over, the atmosphere became a little strained. During the press conference, Stone Winters had radiated an irresistible vivaciousness and sensuality. Her smile was infectious, and her humor earthy and laced with double entendre. But later I saw what Steers meant when he told me she was cold. It was as if a shield had slid down into place. She was totally indifferent to me. I think I would have preferred an obvious dislike to such casual disregard. Breck, on the other hand, seemed outgoing and friendly, despite his predatory manner. It made me wonder why the game's most celebrated bad guy was being so nice to me, taking me under his wing and giving me friendly advice.
So, you've earned the service,
he said.
See any action?
I shook my head. The only action I saw was in boot camp. I spent most of my hitch at the Supply Corps.
Nothing to be ashamed of,
he said.
The Supply Corps is the backbone of the service. They were able to procure an iron arm for me when I lost my own in the Belta Uprising.
He held up a normal-looking, black-gloved hand. Steers said you designed it.
This one, yeah. I have since replaced the original prosthetic. I found it inadequate to my needs.
What do you think of Steers?
Ein loudmouthed, loutish bigot,
Breck said.
Ah, he's never played the game. He's the sort who dreams of accomplishing great things, but lacks the courage to make the attempt, so he resents all who do. He's reached his level, and there he will remain, forever ein secondary talent und ein superficial human being. He will act the part of your best friend and then denigrate you when your back is turned. I find him altogether too insignificant to bother with.
I smiled at the neat and dispassionate summation. And what about Stone Winters? He smiled back.
Ein work in progress.
What does that mean?
It isn't easy to arrange your priorities and worldview at her age, yet that is precisely what she's doing, in a very conscious, very deliberate way. The adventure scenarios have changed her totally. Ah, I've seen the phenomenon before in combat. Ein pampered, directionless young person who has never had to struggle to achieve anything suddenly finds meaning in the highly charged atmosphere of combat. Life becomes pure, reduced to bare essentials. Choices become simple and final. Stone is a young woman who's only recently discovered that all her life she has been nothing but a construct. She doesn't give a damn about the voyeur / exhibitionist element of psychodrome, at least not anymore. She tunes it out. She needs neither the money nor the fame. She needs the constant challenge to help her find out who she is. She doesn't like me, but I can respect her reasons.
And they are?
Her reasons,
Breck said.
If she chooses to share them with you, that is her business.
I nodded. And what do you think of me?
See, my pleasant enough young man, but I am not enthusiastic about being partnered with a newcomer. Tolliver Mondongo designed highly dangerous scenarios. He's tried to kill me several times. He'll try to kill all three of us. It's something that amuses him.
I see, I said. What are the odds of a newcomer surviving his scenarios?
Not very good,
said Breck, as casually as if he were commenting on the weather. I shrugged. Well, I'm a gambler. I like to bet long odds. He raised his eyebrows.
Indeed. And are you prepared to lose?
Nope, I guess that means I better win.
Breck smiled.
Excuse me, but somehow you do not strike me as a very successful gambler. What is your game?
Most anything. But I like poker best.
You have the face for it. We shall have to play someday.
Do we play chess?
Yes, but not with you.
And why not with me?
Because we may play poker someday.
Breck frowned.
I don't understand.
A good chess player can tell a lot about how his opponent thinks from the way he plays. You don't strike me as the sort to go in for a friendly game. You like to win. And as I said, I'm not prepared to lose.
Breck smiled again.
I might have underestimated you. This may prove to be an interesting game.
With players who don't seem to like each other very much,
I said.
Did I give you the impression I don't like you?
Breck said. His voice took on a slight edge.
Or is it the other way around, perhaps?
I shook my head.
I'm not threatened by your superior abilities, Breck. I respect them. But I don't enjoy being sized up and categorized. Maybe it's our fault, all those of us who were born the old-fashioned way, but I've observed a certain attitude of us and them among genetic hybrids. I don't like being condescended to, and I don't like being manipulated. We've been teamed for this game, and you've already decided I'm a handicap. Now you're trying to get a fix on how much of a handicap. I suppose I can understand that, but I don't have to like it.
Breck grinned.
Well done, O'Toole. I've been properly chastised. But it occurs to me that I am not the only one who's been sizing up and categorizing. If it will make you feel any better, or more secure, I'll authorize you access to my psychological database for you. Cards on the table, as you gamblers say.
Meaning, of course, that I'll have to reciprocate with access to my own file once it's been compiled. Is that it?
You would object?
Yes, I would. But you already knew that, which is why you made the offer. I think I'd prefer to have that game of poker, but only if you wear short sleeves.
Breck chuckled and put a hand on my shoulder, giving it a friendly squeeze. He used his natural hand, but the strength of his grip could have fooled me.
I like you, O'Toole. You are refreshingly free of artifice. Unfortunately, you may find that a hindrance in this game.
It was the last chance I had to speak with him before the game initiation. After the press conference, I was taken back to my hotel room, where I changed and packed new clothes the company had been kind enough to buy for me, and then began the coverage of the lottery winner's participation for the game. I had time to myself only when I slept and went to the bathroom. We left the hotel and took a limo to the corporation headquarters in Midtown Manhattan. I completed all the necessary paperwork, shook hands with the appropriate dignitaries, taped a pitch for the lottery. It happened to me. It can happen to you. And then it was back to the limo and off to Brooklyn, to the Downstate Medical Center, for the medical and psychological stages of game preparation. The physical was routine, but exhaustive, and I was pronounced healthy, in excellent condition. Then followed hours of conversations with psychiatrists, several batteries of tests, and more talks with the shrinks. I've always had my doubts about psychiatry. I had gone through similar sessions during my enlistment processing, though none quite so exhaustive, so it wasn't entirely new. The thing about psychiatrists that bothers me is that they never turn it off. Analysis becomes like a disease with them, and one of the symptoms that it manifests is the belief that they know all about people. As I said, I have my doubts. I suspect they know all about certain mechanistic properties and linkages that have to do with various neuroses and conditions, much as doctors recognize diseases by their symptoms. But that's a far cry from knowing the works of the human mind so well that you can reduce them to some sort of comprehensive schema. Yet I have never met a shrink that did not, at least in some respect, pretend a sort of godlike omniscience. Having the ability to understand people is not the same as knowing what makes them tick. The first requires empathy. The second requires a very deep and intimate knowledge of another human being, and you can't achieve that without risking involvement. And I sure as hell don't believe you can achieve it through scoring a test. Nevertheless, those test scores and evaluations of my sessions were all going into a confidential file, a database for access only by company physicians and player masters, a dossier that purported to be me, reduced to bare essentials. I told them what I thought of that, and that went into the file too. Surgery came next. Needless to say, I didn't remember anything about it except going to sleep in the operating theater and waking up after it was over, bald and with a bandage on my head.
The truly interesting part came when I learned how to use the biochip. Actually, there wasn't much to learn, as it did not really require my doing anything. It merely required my getting used to it. The programmers started with fairly simple procedures, such as transmitting images to my mind, which I was then asked to identify and describe in detail. Then the procedure was reversed, with me sitting in another room at a table piled with various objects, looking at them and handling them to see how well the reception worked. It apparently worked fine. Then we proceeded to telepathic communication, and I found it both fascinating and somewhat disquieting to hear voices in my mind. I was informed that my reactions were excellent, as was my adaptability quotient, whatever that was. It seems it was not unusual for people to lose their cool completely when strange voices started speaking in their brains. The most amazing and, to me, most pleasurable part of the procedure was the computer interface. It was like a form of sleep learning. I was given a mild sedative and made comfortable on a reclining couch. This was also to be a test of tachyon broadcast and reception, though on an extremely short range. I was asked if I had any preference of learning programs for test transmission purposes, and I selected something I had always wanted to learn. I fell asleep and woke up after a nap of about 2 hours, feeling relaxed, refreshed, and possessing a fluent knowledge of the Russian language. Now I could converse with my archbishops in their native tongue. To me, this was worth everything I had gone through, including almost getting killed. I found that I could take a 10-minute nap during computer interface and wake up having read all of War and Peace. I could interact with the computer and study engineering or world history or foreign languages. I could take a half-hour courses in combat weaponry and wake up an expert on the subject. The purpose of the computer learning programs was to prepare me for the various game scenarios of Psychodrome, but so long as I played the game, I would have the option of buying time on the computer for my own use between the game scenarios. It wasn't cheap, and having a biochip implanted on my own would have cost a fortune, but it was worth it. And I realized that so long as I would have that opportunity, I would make full use of it. My only disappointment came on learning that I could not simply interface indiscriminately. There was danger of what they called cerebral overload. Too much of a good thing, I suppose. The mind needed time to recuperate and assimilate. Without that time, there was serious risk of psychosis, and my access time would be limited by psych tests to determine my assimilation quotient. Everything seemed to be a quotient or a factor. Accumulating knowledge, I was told, could be highly addictive, and it was necessary to protect people from knowing too much. I let that straight line pass to avoid having my rejoinder go into my file. I was learning. On the last day of my preparation, my player master came to visit me. Tolliver Mondego was an old man with a somber, sepulchral voice and deeply set, penetrating dark eyes. He was tall and gaunt, with large, heavily veined hands and a long, mournful-looking face, deeply etched by age. I thought of Marley's ghost without the chains. He sat down beside my bed. I was required to rest for at least 6 hours after interface, and looked down at me with a fatherly indulgence.
"How are you feeling?"
he said after introducing himself. All sorts of associations sprang to mind upon hearing that deep, tomb-like voice. Coleridge's Ancient Mariner, the ghost of Hamlet's father, Oedipus Rex tearing out his eyes.
Fine, Mr. Mondego. And yourself?
Well, thank you. I wanted to give you the chance to grow accustomed to my voice so that it will not disorient you when I establish contact during the game. Are you nervous?
No, I don't think so.
Good. Better to take things as they come. Have you any questions?
I guess I'd like to know what to expect.
Expect the challenge of your lifetime, Mr. O'Toole.
I was hoping for a somewhat more explicit answer, I said. Mondego smiled.
Very well. Your first scenario will involve jungle combat. And that is all I will tell you for the moment.
He stood and turned to leave, then hesitated and reached into his pocket.
Oh, I almost forgot. This message arrived for you this morning. Since you were indisposed, I took the liberty of signing for it.
I took the message. It consisted of only two words.
You're dead.
There was nothing to reveal who sent it, but I had an excellent idea. I glanced up at Mondigo, but could not read his impassive, woebegone expression.
Good luck, Mr. O'Toole,
he said. End of chapter.